Welcome to the Transformational Leadership Podcast. This is your host, Hannah Anam. My mission is to help you lead more effectively and be an agent of positive change in times of disruption. On this podcast, we interview practitioners and leadership experts and have coaching exercises that you can apply immediately to your work challenges. Together, we learn how to achieve success and create workplaces in a world that work better for all. I am so excited today to welcome Harry Kramer. Harry is the former chairman and chief executive officer of Baxter International, a multi-billion dollar global healthcare company. He is a professor of management and strategy at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He's also an executive partner with Madison Dearborn Partners, one of the largest private equity firms in the US, where he consults with portfolio CEOs. His third book is Your 168, Finding Purpose and Satisfaction in a Values-Based Life. This is a book that just launched this week, and I'm so excited to be part of your book launch party here, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Great to be with you.
Beautiful. So I know that your last books have been all about values. I'm curious if you'd share a story about what's important to you about values. Is there like a pivotal experience that made values really important?
Sure. So the crazy story, Hannah, is I was a senior in college. I went to a small college in Wisconsin, Lawrence University. And when I was a senior, I started dating a young girl who, I will admit, Hannah, she was a freshman when I was a senior. In fact, I met her first day of school. And things were going really well. But since I was a senior, I graduated early. And it turned out that I went down to Chicago. So I tell my five children they can't do this now. But 40 years ago, I used to hitchhike up every other weekend to visit her. And this went well until her father called me. Very serious guy in St. Paul, Minnesota. What's going on? What's happening here? We need to spend some time together. I said, super. He said, well, you come up to Minnesota. We spend a weekend together. And I said, okay, super. So I flew up to Minnesota to meet this fellow, trying to be serious. It's my girlfriend's father. And he said, we're going to do something this weekend. And I said, super. What are we going to do? Maybe see a football game? He goes, no. We're going on a retreat. And I said, well, what's a retreat? He goes, well, you'll find out. You spend a little time thinking about your values and your purpose. So I didn't say super. I thought, whoa. And he said, there's something I should tell you before we start. It's a silent retreat. I said, what does that mean? He said, well, you're not going to be talking for 3 days. And that's when I said, Hannah, how much do I really like this guy's daughter, right? I could be back in Chicago in 45 minutes, but being a finance guy, sunk costs, I'm already there. So I actually did this for 3 days. And at the end of it, they said, this shouldn't be a one-time exercise. This is run by the Jesuits, pretty serious group of guys. And at the end of it, they said, this shouldn't be a one-time exercise. You should spend 15 minutes a day taking the time to think a little bit about what your purpose is, what your values are, what matters, and do a self-examination. So I thought, I'll try this for a week. Well, I've done this 15-minute exercise, Hannah, at the end of every day now for almost the last 40 years.
Wow, and that's amazing.
And the conclusion of it, which is remarkable, is I tell the students, the end of the story is, not only did I marry his daughter, but for the last almost 40 consecutive years now, the first weekend in December, wherever I am in the world, I fly to Minnesota and I do this 3-day silent retreat with my father-in-law every year. And that combination of taking 3 days once a year, your values, your purpose, what matters, and then do a 15-minute check-in at the end of every day, for me, literally keeps me in line with what's really important, what isn't. How do you prioritize? How do you separate activity and productivity?
Wow, what an inspiring story. What an inspiring story. So share with me, how do you define your purpose?
I think this gets very individual because everybody looks at it differently. I sort of look at it and to say, what do I believe? What do I think? I actually think I'm here for a blink of an eye. You and I are having a nice discussion today, Hannah. And if you said, well, when were you in college? I'd say, well, I don't know. Was that 5-6 years ago? No, that was 40 years ago. And so I went from being 22 to 62 like that. So when I realize I'm really here for a blink of an eye, And I think of it as the difference of, okay, what kind of example can I set for my children? What kind of a relationship can I have with my spouse, Julie? In my work life, when I was a CEO of Baxter, to me, it wasn't the power of a $12 billion company managing 55,000 people. It was, can I set a positive example of what matters and preparing people for the life they want to lead? right? Is it literally about success or is it about significance, right? Is it my resume or is it what people are going to say about me at a eulogy? And I think by putting things in perspective, setting an example, not getting too caught up in the day-to-day materialism of the world, but trying to set an example is the way I think about my purpose.
That's so inspiring, I think, for many of us who, I know all of us have really busy lives, but the fact that you have this deep commitment to a 15-minute practice every single day and this 3-day retreat every single December, that is so inspiring that being a CEO of a large company that you can take the time to do that. And obviously the dad of 5 kids, right? That you can take the time to do that is so, so inspiring. So in your work with Madison Dearborn Partners, you advise a lot of CEOs. And what advice are you giving them now as it relates to these times of disruption? Because it strikes me that in times of disruption, the role of a leader is so disproportionately even more powerful, right? Because things are changing so rapidly and your ability to really create an emerging future and influence it becomes so powerful. So what advice are you giving CEOs?
Yeah, Hannah, great question, because the way I look at it, and you summarize it so well, that most of us, in fact, all of us, when there's an issue, when there's a crisis, when there's difficulties, the things that immediately pop in are things like worry, fear, anxiety, pressure, and stress, just to name 5, right? Now, once you're into it, right, if you're upset about something, Hannah, and I say, oh, Hannah, don't worry about it, well, it's like you're already worried. You're already dealing with that. And what I try to instruct folks is, you know what you need to do? You need to take some time to be a little self-reflective. Because one of the big advantages of this, Hannah, one of the big advantages is if you're self-reflective, you won't be surprised that often, because we all know it isn't a question of if there's going to be a crisis. So since we know, Hannah, that there are these bad things going to happen, I actually convinced myself, and I convinced a lot of the folks I work with, no matter what happens, I will do 2 things. I will try to do the right thing. I'll do the best I can do. I'll try to do the right thing. I'll do the best I can do. Now, when you say you're going to do the right thing, Hannah, that makes one enormous assumption. What is the right thing? I better surround myself, Hannah, with some very good people whose values I appreciate that'll help me figure that out in an uncertain world, and we'll do the best we can do. Now, interestingly enough, if you can actually convince yourself, I know we're going through this quickly, that no matter what happens, I'll do the right thing, I'll do the best I can do, worry, fear, anxiety, pressure, and stress can be significantly reduced. They'll never be eliminated. Welcome to the human race, Hannah. And some would say, we've all had bosses that would say, Hannah, a little bit of pressure is really good. Well, the problem is we got a lot more than a little bit. And I think that ability to put things into perspective helps you to manage yourself. And once you can manage yourself, now you can lead other people. The leader in a period of crisis, he or she has got an amazing amount of things going on. And you know what, Hannah? You either let it overwhelm you, or you put it in perspective. I'll do the right thing. I'll do the best I can do.
Beautiful. I love those 2. Almost they're like little mantras, right? That we can say to ourselves that can just calm ourselves down. And in particular, I will do the right thing is a very much of a North Star to say, I'll do the right thing. So it gives you a sense of safety and certainty. Right. When there is no certainty around us, you can ground yourself in your own values of doing the right thing. And then I love this idea of I'll do the best that I can do, because there's so much that is not within our control. And I think that is so hard for us that we can't control things that are really important in our lives, like the health of our loved ones, or perhaps even a job or a paycheck, right? They're outside of our control. And just being able to say to ourselves, I'll do the best that I can do, and that's good enough, is such a, I love that. It's such a calming influence. One thing that you shared with me that I think it would be great for our listeners is, as you do these 15-minute reflections, what advice do you have for people? Are there a set of questions that they should be asking themselves? Is there a set of 2 or 3 questions that really help them discover what values are really important to them, or a sense of purpose that's really important to them?
Yeah, really good, Hannah. In fact, I'll actually send you the list on for both of them for that you can pass on. So the way I look at it, Hannah, on the once a year, I'm looking at the big picture. I'm looking at the next year of my life, and I'm literally saying, what are my values? What is my purpose? What really matters? What kind of a leader do I want to be? What kind of example do I want to set in my life? Okay. Now, on a nightly basis, and again, I'm not a morning guy, a lot of teaching, a lot of boards, so I'm sort of the midnight guy. I literally go through a personal self-examination at the end of every day. And the questions that I go through at the end of the day go a little bit like this. Hannah, what did I say I was going to do today? What did I actually do? What am I proud of? What am I not proud of? Okay. If I live today over again, what would I have done differently? And then the last one, Hannah, is if I have tomorrow, knowing fully well where sooner or later I won't, but if I do have tomorrow and I'm a learning person based on what I learned today, how will I operate differently tomorrow in my life? As a father, as a spouse, as a leader, as a colleague. And again, it literally puts me in a position now where tomorrow I'll try to do the right thing. I'll do the best I can do. And as you correctly said, we'll never get everything done. Okay. We're never going to be close to perfect. Right. But this leadership thing, as you well know, Anna, isn't a destination. It's a journey. And I will constantly work on try to get better. And some days it'll be 2 steps forward and 1.5 steps back. But I'm on a journey.
Beautiful. I love those questions because there is this sense of, to me, what I heard in them is the sense of personal accountability, taking personal accountability for learning every day, taking personal accountability for doing the best you can. And then taking a personal accountability for this sense of, you know, who do I want to be that I'm proud of?
Exactly.
I love these sets of questions. I think our listeners are going to really benefit from them. So the CEO or C-level leader's job is hard in the best of times because there is no rule book. By the time they get to CEO, most decisions are in the gray zone, right? There's no best practice that they can turn to. As a former CEO of Baxter, what are some of the toughest decisions that you had to make? And can you share a little bit of story around as CEOs and C-level leaders or leaders of any company are trying to make decisions in these tough times? What do they find solace in?
Wow, great questions. And the way I think about this, and you'll notice throughout my whole themes here is, you got to keep this simple. You have to keep this simple because people can get overwhelmed very easily. And as you well know, Hannah, when you're the leader, a very big part of this is communication, effective communication, making sure people know what's going on, why it's happening, how it impacts them, what you need from them. And what unfortunately happens, and I'm sure you see this in your work, Hannah, very often when things are going well, lots of communication, we're doing all these things, but when things aren't going well, communication awfully declines. It's a little bit like, well, I'm not going to communicate as much until I have a better sense of what is going to happen. And my very, very strong opinion, Hannah, is however much you communicate when things are going well, you have to communicate at least 3 times more often when things aren't going well. And then I get a CEO will say to me, but wait a minute, but I'm not sure I know the answer. And I said, well, that's fine. But here's the little 3-step formula I use with everybody, Hannah. And it turns out to work out pretty well. Little 3-step. You and I are in a company, you and I are running an organization, and now all of a sudden there's uncertainty, there's issues, whatever. The way I look at it is, little 3-step. Number one, Hannah, we're gonna tell people what we know. Here's what we know. And by the way, it isn't ego, it isn't being a lunatic, it isn't making stuff up. In an uncertain world, what do we know? Number one. Number two, what don't we know? We're not going to pretend we know everything. We're not going to pretend we're going to know how long this crisis is going to go on, whatever. Okay. We just don't know. And number three, we'll let you know how quickly we'll get back to you with what we don't know. What does that do? It creates some trust. It creates credibility, some vulnerability. You know, hey, Harry's telling us what he knows. He's admitting he doesn't know this, and he's telling us what he's going to try to do. That ability to say, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, and when we get back to you, creates an environment that people can stay calm enough that they can now be more active to figure things out rather than running around in circles. But it does require you to not have such an ego where you're unwilling to say, I don't know. The other way of thinking about Henna is very, very simple a model for leadership. Leadership is about the ability to influence people. The way you influence people is you have to relate to people. Interestingly enough, Henna, as you well know, most people don't relate to people who know everything. Most people do not relate well to people that never make a mistake. How do you relate to these people, right? So that relatability, calmness is what I think leaders need to do, particularly in a period of change and crisis.
Beautiful. I love this idea of relatability and vulnerability and humility, because I think it's so hard for folks, particularly by the time they get to the top, that they've everything that has worked for them is knowing the answers, right? And now to be able to admit that they don't know is so hard for the ego. I hope that this pandemic is going to help each of us be leaders who can be very comfortable in our vulnerability and in our humanity and in our comfort with not knowing the answers. Your time as CEO your time as CEO, of when you had to make a really tough decision and you had to dig deep into your own values to figure out how do you make that decision?
Sure. In fact, there's a lot of examples. So one of the situations that you remind me of that occurred was in 2001 when one of the product lines that Baxter has made for many, many years is dialyzers, which is a product that needs to be used for people that have kidney failure. Because if your kidneys aren't working, you either get dialyzed or you die. And Baxter was one of the originators of dialysis many, many years ago. And we make many different dialyzers. But what so happened that suddenly we get calls from Spain that several people had died. And of course, when people have kidney failure, there's often comorbid conditions. So did they die because there's something wrong with the dialyzer? Or was it something else? Was it the fact there wasn't enough sterile water? And immediately we were told, oh, we don't think it was Baxter's dialyzer. We think it may have been the water. But I remember them thinking, we think. Well, they didn't really know, right? So we said, all right, well, what's the right thing to do? We immediately said, we're going to stop selling the product. We're going to recall the product. And we're going to investigate immediately what happened. And immediately we just said the three steps. Here's what we know. Several people have died. Well, we don't know, was it Baxter's dialyzer or not? Here's what we're doing. We're sending some forensic scientists. We're going to figure it out. And I remember there was a lot of concern of, well, geez, if we don't know it was our dialyzer, should we really do that? We're going to have to write off. We're going to have to close the plant. We're going to have all this inventory that we're going to have to destroy. And what do we do? Well, we know what we're going to do. We'll try to do the right thing. We'll do the best we can do. And we ended up closing the plant, writing off $185 million. And interestingly enough, I got asked a lot of questions during interviews by Fast Company and other people of, boy, that must have been a very difficult decision. The stock declined and so on. And this was not a humility comment, but I said, honestly, it really wasn't that tough a decision because as an organization, we said, we'll do the right thing. We'll do the best we can do. In fact, I said to one fellow, if I had done something different, then I would have had a problem because I had 55,000 people who actually believed I worked for this company because they're going to do the right thing. And you're going to have people that are going to be telling you, well, Harry, we're not so sure it was the dialyzer. We're not so sure. And I remember telling one person, a scientist saying, okay, you're saying you're not sure. Well, let me ask you a question. You have a 5-year-old daughter. I said, if God forbid she had kidney failure, would you give her one of these dialyzers? And he didn't answer the question. And I said, I think we did answer the question, okay? If we're not sure, we got to recall, we have to get rid of all these dialyzers, right? So in my mind, and by the way, I'm such an idealist, about 4 or 5 months after that, I started getting calls from companies that had never used our dialyzers that said, we're going to start using Baxter dialyzers. I said, why is that? He says, well, because we know when there's a problem, we know that Baxter will do the right thing. And I thought, wow, here's a story I'll be able to tell as a professor for the next 20 years.
Beautiful. Wow. What a beautiful story. And I imagine that at that time, you know, in a CEO's role, there's a lot of competing voices. You've got possibly the voice of the CFO saying, hey, do we really want to write this off? Here's the impact on the stock price. You've got the analyst, right, that you're thinking, I'm going to have to answer to them. You've got board members possibly, right, that are sort of not exactly on the same page as you. So the role of the CEO in and or senior leader is to figure out, how do I bring all of these other voices, these sometimes competing voices, and still make a decision that needs to be made? How do I align these voices around one common set of values or a sense of purpose? Talk about how great CEOs do that. How were you able to be able to galvanize people around this decision? Because, you know, writing off 180 plus million dollars worth and closing plants, these are not easy decisions in many, many ways.
You know, again, Hannah, I have to say, you really do ask great questions, because this is a question that I end up dealing with all of the time on all the boards and in the classroom with the MBA students at Northwestern Kellogg. And here's the way I think about this. And I often tell my students, Hannah, by the way, I have very, very few answers. I have many opinions. In fact, I usually say, I don't do Q&A, I do Q&O, question and opinion. And you're asking now, I think, one of the most fundamental questions. I applaud you for that. And here's the typical thing that goes on. You're a CEO. And by the way, you could be a president. You could be a small business, large. It's the same in my mind. But let's just use the CEO for a minute. You have, as you said, a lot of different stakeholders. I don't use the word employees, but I have my team. I got my customers. I got my suppliers. I got society. I got the government. I got the shareholders. I got the board. Well, boy, how do I deal with this? And most people see this as a tremendous amount of conflict with one another. And the surprise maybe is I don't look at it as a conflict. I try to step back, a little self-reflection. I literally try to get from the roots to the trees to the forest. How do I put this whole mosaic together? And here's the way I think about it. If I'm in a publicly traded company, I've got to generate a return for my shareholders. So this whole idea of, am I going to generate a return for my shareholders? I think the reason you bought the stock in my company, Hannah, is that you wanted to eventually buy a house, or you wanted to send your daughter to college, or you wanted to retire. So the fact that I have to earn a return for you, I don't view as this bad free market capitalistic thing. But here's the key. How do I do that? Well, let's step back. Let's get real simple. The first thing I need to do is I need to have great people. I need to have phenomenal people. Well, as you and I know, and particularly now in the new younger generation, your daughter, my children, they're not going to work for an organization that's not doing the right thing. So guess what? If I can say, you know what, as an organization, we're going to do the right thing, okay? We're going to care about the environment. You know what we're going to do? We're going to give our employees a day off every several months to do something for a nonprofit or Habitat for Humanity. By doing that and stating, not talk, not a marketing brochure, but those are the things we're going to do, we gain really good people. Ah, what's the next thing we need? Now we need customers, right? So I'll look at it and say, okay, I'm the manufacturer and you're handling the customer. You can buy the product from two people. You can buy it from me or you can buy it from Mary. Now, Harry's focused on shareholder value. That's all he cares about. Mary cares about value, shareholder value, but she's doing all these things for society. She's being a good person. If the price of the product is anywhere close, the quality is anywhere close, you're going to buy the product from Mary. Simple equation. If by doing the right thing and getting enough good people to think that through, then you've got a great team and you've got a great relationship with your customer and you're doing the right thing, you'll generate a return. So rather than, well, am I going to do this or am I going to do that? Am I going to do the right thing for society? Am I going to focus on shareholders? I always tease Hannah in my classes, if I ask you a question, if you answer yes, you always get partial credit. Because the answer usually is yes. How do you look at it together? Not this or that. You know, and right now in the media, there's all, well, are these companies, are they going to focus on the shareholder? Or are they going to focus on society? I think the answer is yes. And getting from the roots to the trees to the forest, being able to look at this holistically, partly as a result of being self-reflective, you can make it happen.
Yeah, such a beautiful thought. I mean, I love the way that you've tied this notion of being self-reflective, right, and understanding what your priorities are, and also self-reflective from the perspective of taking that giant step back from the tree to the forest to the sky, perhaps, right, and looking at everything. And how that giant step back and understanding your values really helps you understand that fundamentally what matters to everybody is doing the right thing, whether that is your customer or your employees, and even from the perspective of shareholders, creating long-term share value, that is what really is at the core of, you know, the experience of everybody in the ecosystem. I sit on the board of the largest publicly traded company in Pakistan. And we're a very, very purpose-driven company. And I've been reading a lot about triple bottom lines and the fact that, you know, even folks like the CEO of BlackRock, Larry Fink, is talking about how climate risk and some of these, you know, shared collective risks are business risks. And the fact that we need to find mechanisms to go from really short-term value creation. Okay, yes, this quarter I had to write off $180 million and that, you know, drove my share price down, which I think so many CEOs get stuck on, yeah, versus creating longer term value and finding ways for us to look at companies from the perspective of what value did they create for a whole bunch of stakeholders. How do we redesign how we evaluate, for example, CEO pay, right? Because so much of it is focused on, you know, what value did you create? How do we reassess all of this to create a system that can work better so that it focuses on us on measuring the things that are the right thing to do?
You, Hannah, you always ask great questions because these are the kind of things we're spending a lot of time at Northwestern on now, because what ends up happening, and it's a little trite phrase, but I always say one of our biggest problems is we incentivize people to do things and then we wonder why they did exactly what they did. Okay. You know, guess what? Look in the mirror. So if you really want to change this, I think compensation needs to be based on a much longer term, not so much this quarter to quarter, all right? Because again, that's what you're incentivizing people to do. So why are you confused? Why are you surprised? Let's talk about all the issues in the world. You mentioned some global poverty, global healthcare issues, the digital divide, the environment. And I'll say to the students, who is going to deal with all these issues? And usually the group of people we assign to this is this famous group of people that I refer to as those guys. There's some magical group of men or women somewhere. No, not me. And what I try to explain to the students is, hey, you know what? If you're going to a place like Northwestern Kellogg School of Management, or you're in a senior role in a company, you are those guys. I mean, if we're not those guys, who the heck is? All right. And then once you say, I own this, okay, I'm part of this. And I think right now, one of the reasons I teach value-based leadership, my opinion, we have a leadership vacuum in this country and in the world, which is enormous. That's why I'm hoping to be able to teach this the next 20 years, God willing.
Beautiful. And we need you, Harry, to influence the CEOs, obviously, that are listening to your advice, and the young students, the minds that you're shaping. I love this notion that you have, Harry, of taking personal accountability for these collective issues. And we need en masse, a lot of us, to take this sense of personal responsibility, because we're part of this shared experience we call planet Earth that we're creating. And each person has the ability to make something better. It could be something in your community. It could be something in your workplace. And it could be certainly something in the world. And every time you lend a hand, you make something happen that's better. And I'm so inspired because my book, Wired for Disruption, is really about being a force for good in these times of disruption. You know, leaders have disproportionate impact because they get to create and shape an emerging future as it changes. And our ability to step into being a force for good, being purposeful, being values driven is so important. I'm so inspired and feel so good that we have folks like you in our ecosystem that are helping shape and influence young minds.
Well, thank you, Hannah. And I appreciate everything that you're doing. And I want to get a copy of your book as well, because it's something that fits in perfectly with what I'm trying to teach students and what I'm trying to do when I'm working on these boards with these CEOs. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you today.
Thanks for listening. This is your host, Hannah Anand. Please rate, comment, and share our podcast with those you care about. Be the leader who helps others grow and thrive in times of disruption. You can visit our website at www.transformleaders.tv.
there, you'll find other great tools to grow your leadership and be a force for good in these times. Until the next time, my friends.